This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with Rick Wolf and Harriet Fried, two contributors to the new book, Imagine, Living in a Socialist USA.
If you ever wondered about life under socialism, our two guests will tell you first, the shape of a post-capitalist future, Rick Wolf, and Harriet Fried will tell you about personal, emotional, and sexual life without capitalism.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, I know all of us, you know, growing up in the 60s, 70s, 80s, Pete Seeger was one of our great loves and really a heroic person, not just for his music, but for his stance, of course, against the committees that were investigating communism, et cetera, the McCarthy period. And I know you had some personal knowledge of Pete as well as your son Eli did. But why don't you give us some of your reminiscence of Pete Seeger?
Pete died last week at age 94. My son Eli Smith is 32. And when Eli was a young teenager, he was offered a job at Camp Kinderland, where Pete Seeger once taught guitar. After Pete was blacklisted because he was a communist, he would tell you he was a communist with a small c, but nonetheless, he was in our camp. And as a consequence, he was put on the Red Channels list. He couldn't get a job anywhere. And he went around and he taught and sang at children's camps and high schools and small clubs. And one of the places that he worked was Camp Kinderland in New York State. And Eli, at age 14, got offered the job that Pete Seeger once had in the 50s. And Eli really didn't know what to do. So he wrote a letter to Pete Seeger and asked him, how do you teach this course on playing the banjo? Well, Pete Seeger didn't write back. The phone rang in our apartment. I picked it up. I said, hello. And he said, this is Pete Seeger. May I speak with Eli Smith, please? Now, Eli got on the phone. And for 45 minutes, Eli and Pete Seeger traded songs and talked about how you teach children the banjo. That's the kind of person he was. If the Wall Street Journal would have written him, he probably wouldn't have got back to him. But when a 14-year-old child wrote him to ask him for some help, he picked up the phone and called him.
You brought out the point, Michael, about the blacklist and when he was no longer really played anywhere or he couldn't play anywhere. And, of course, at the time that happened, and you know the history better than I, he was a part of the Almanac Singers. And they had the number one hit record in the United States, Good Night Irene, which I think was a Lead Belly song originally. I think so.
Lead Belly.
That was the number one song. And then they accused him of being a communist. And interesting about the Almanac Singers, we're recording in the West Village, and the house they all lived in is literally two blocks from the house. It's West 10th Street.
Yeah.
And the Almanac Singers all lived there, along with a million other wonderful musicians.
Yeah, it was a collective of leftists who supported the rise of the CIO and the unions, and he was one of them. So Woody Guthrie was another. And then the group kind of morphed into the Weavers. It was actually the Weavers that had that hit song, Goodnight Irene, number one song. That was a song of Lead Belly's. Lead Belly was a black prisoner in Texas. John and Alan Lomax, the song collectors, went down and recorded him and recorded that song. Alan Lomax befriended Lead Belly, brought him up to New York, and Lead Belly sang for people who were socialists and integrated audiences. This was very unusual for the times. And he sang a lot of songs, including Bourgeois Blues, which was my favorite song. He went down with Alan Lomax to D.C. to do a concert, and the hotels down there wouldn't let him rent a room. Lomax could get a room because he was white, but Lead Belly couldn't get a room. So he made up a song called the Bourgeois Blues, where he said that Washington, D.C. was a bourgeois town. And the last line of the song is an inscription that I had over my doorway for many years, and it goes, land of the brave, home of the free, I don't want to be mistreated by no bourgeoisie.
We referred to it, the blacklist, but it was worse than just being, not worse, he was put on a blacklist, he couldn't play, but he was also called before the House Un-American Activities Committee. And the purpose of that is to try and get people to say they were communists and then tell about all their friends who were communists. And there were two types of answers you could give to the question of are you a communist or wasn't. In his case, it was a question of was a particular section of the party a communist party or something. And you could take either what's called the First Amendment, which is your right to have political associations, have a free mind, think what you want, or you could take the Fifth Amendment, which says I will not incriminate myself. Now, what's interesting about all of this is that the people who took the Fifth Amendment wouldn't be held in contempt because you have a right not to answer questions unless you were given immunity, and I don't want to go through that here. But basically, if you took the Fifth Amendment, and that negative term they used was Fifth Amendment communists, even though you never said you were a communist, you took the Fifth Amendment when you were asked whether you were a communist. And those people didn't have to go to jail. They didn't get convicted unless there was a given immunity, which wasn't the general case. Other people took the First Amendment, which says, I have a right to political association. Those people, there was no right to do that. Yeah, you could say it, but it didn't protect you from contempt of Congress for not answering the question and getting a jail term. And those are called First Amendment, not communists, but First Amendment, people who took the First Amendment. Seeger took the First Amendment, refused to rely on the Fifth, and they asked him a question, and his statement is as follows. Mr. Seeger, this is 1955. I am not going to answer any questions as to my association, my philosophical or religious beliefs, or my political beliefs, or how I voted in any election or any of these private affairs. I think these are very improper questions for any American to be asked, especially under such compulsion as this. I would be very glad to tell you my life if you want to hear of it.
Yeah. And then he told him, Michael, he told him, and if you want me to, I'll sing you some songs.
So they held him in contempt, right?
Well, he got a year in prison.
Right.
And he almost went. And fortunately, it was overturned on appeal. But
in the Supreme Court, it was overturned.
Yeah, yeah.
The case went all the way.
Yeah, yeah. But he was a brave man. He was ready to go to prison rather than tell these people stuff that they had no right to ask. And he wasn't going to tell people, these guys, about his political associations. Looking back at it, they're the ones who are shamed now.
Thank you, Pete Seeger.
To everything, turn, 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 there is a season. Turn, 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 and a time to every purpose under heaven. A time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant, a time to reap, a time to kill, a time to heal, a time to laugh, a time to weep. Do everything, turn, 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 there is a season, turn, 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 and a time to every purpose under heaven.
Michael, the revelations about the national security state just don't stop coming in. And Obama's response to them hasn't been that muscular, to say the least. What's your take on it?
You know, we all heard the speech, or at least a lot of us heard the speech a couple of weeks ago on the NSA. And I had not expected much from the speech, and we'd figured it was a way to sort of calm the waters so that it would look like he was doing something when, in fact, nothing is going to change with regard to the NSA. And, of course, that was the case. But, you know, it was so much worse than I ever expected, and I expect the worst from government officials like Obama. I mean, I'm completely not just cynical. I just think they represent a power interest, you know, that is completely antithetical to the interests of human beings. So I sat there. I was actually in a studio at MSNBC because they wanted me to respond. And so I listened to the speech, and it opens with the story of Paul Revere. Now, you all know who Paul Revere is. Paul Revere was one of our, quote, patriots. He was a silversmith in Boston. He led the so-called Paul Revere's ride and all this. Anyway, he's a major American patriot. And he says, well, here's a story about Paul Revere. Paul Revere had a committee called the Surveillance Committee. And what the Surveillance Committee did was in the evening they would go out and they would spy on the British. And that's what their job was. So spying basically is revolutionary, it's patriotic, etc. And then Obama continued along that line, giving all these instances in U.S. wars where we use spies. You know, Civil War, we had balloons over the
air balloons over the troops for the Confederacy so we could see what they were doing. First World War, Second World War, all spies. When I said it, I couldn't imagine that it would be as bad as it was. That's what I'm saying, because what he did was not begin with saying, we have a constitution, we have a right to privacy, there's a right to not be surveilled, there's a right, you know, to have our own homes and our own private telephone calls. And yes, sometimes we have to invade those rights when it's national security or serious terrorism or, you know, probable cause. Instead, he starts with the flip side. Surveillance is patriotic. So that's our new logo for the show. Surveillance is patriotic. And Orwell died, you know, a number of years ago. The book was 1984. All these phrases could be taken out of books like Animal Farm or George Orwell's other writings. What were they, Michael?
Slave peace.
Slavery is freedom. Surveillance is patriotism. So we start with that as the opening piece of the speech. So it can't get better from there, can it? Of course, it doesn't. And if you go through each of the so-called reforms, and I even hesitate to grace it with that term, and the biggest reform was expected to be, hoped to be, about metadata, which is the taking of the metadata on, you know, billions of phone calls a day, perhaps, in the United States, all our phone calls. And to that, there was nothing. There was basically nothing. He said, well, we're not sure the government's going to keep storing it, but I don't know what we're going to do with all that information. Maybe a private company will store it. Maybe someone else will store it. We'll leave it up to Congress. So that's basically saying, you know, let's just throw the papers in the air, and wherever they fall, they fall. Nothing's going to happen. He did say that the Foreign Surveillance Court had to approve looking at that data once it was collected. So the first thing is the data is being collected and retained still, no change. The change is supposedly the Foreign Surveillance Court is going to be the court that authorized the government to look at it. But that doesn't mean anything. That's a rubber stamp court. They've spent 35 opinions approving of this system. Every judge has approved it. And they have never, as far as I know, perhaps one or two exceptions out of the thousands of times they've been asked to approve government spying and surveillance, they've never turned down one request. So no protection at all on metadata. On the second issue, which is the national surveillance, national security letters, that's a letter that the FBI can issue to a bank, a school, a library, a credit card company to get your information that you, you know, what you've charged, what books you've checked out, what your banking transactions are like. They don't need a court order. They don't need probable cause. They don't need any evidence of criminality. And that people have been fighting to get a warrant requirement. So the FBI can't just willy-nilly without a court issue subpoenas to whoever it wants, not subpoenas, but national security letters to whomever it wants. On that, he did nothing. Zip, zero. Those are two of the big issues that I saw. But in the end, as I titled an article I wrote, it was a bouquet of roses to the national security state.
Obama's own blue ribbon panel, who recommended a bunch of reforms, none of which he's really going to take seriously, said, and this is of crucial importance, that all of this spying hasn't done anything with respect to terrorism. So the question is, well, if it's not terrorism, what the hell are they doing it for? And the answer is social control. This is social control.
In the United States, I think that may be particularly true. Worldwide, it's social control, it's politics, and it's economic spying.
Absolutely.
And it's fundamental. This
they're spying on the banks and trading and so on. If you say that the American government is the executive committee of the business class, the NSA is giving them that kind of economic support.
Our world of trying to make change is opening up, but of course the responses of our government are to basically try and keep it the same or worse.
We're joined today by both Harriet Fraud and Rick Wolf. They are contributors to the new anthology, Imagine, Living in a Socialist USA, a book that I, Michael Smith, Debbie Smith, and Francis Golden edited. It's just come out by HarperCollins. Harriet Fraud wrote the chapter on personal, emotional, and sexual life, without capitalism. She's a hypnotherapist and psychotherapist in Manhattan. Her companion and comrade Rick Wolf, the economist, wrote the chapter called The Shape of a Post-Capitalist Future in the book Imagine Living in a Socialist USA. Rick Wolf is a professor of economics, emeritus from the University of Massachusetts, and currently a visiting professor at the graduate program in international affairs of the New School, University of New York City, and he directs the website Democracy at Work. Rick, Harriet, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Hi, glad to be here.
Same here.
It's good to see you, Rick. Good to see you, Harriet. You're just back. The two of you were on a tour in California, talking about socialism and talking about the economic situation and the personal situation. You've written articles in the book that I edited with Debbie Smith and Francis Golden called Imagine Living in a Socialist USA. We're going to talk to you about your chapters in that book. But before we get there, I wanted to ask you about California because you just had an amazing outpouring of support when you got out there. Rick, what was it like?
Well, we went out there in part to speak for organizations, community organization, in the case of Oakland, progressive radio audiences in the case of KPFA in San Francisco and KPFK in Los Angeles.
Those are our sister stations.
Right. And finally, I spoke at the University of California at Riverside as an invited speaker at the university. And in each case, whether it was to a community organization or to a radio audience or to an academic gathering, what was remarkable was, first, record turnouts. In each and every case, the rooms we were involved in were completely full. In many cases, people had to sit on the floor and stand in the back. The largest audience was in Los Angeles with 750 people who came. In San Francisco was about 650, filling the largest church, the First Congregational Church of Berkeley, the largest auditorium in the city, and so on. I'm struck not just by the size, which was gratifying, but by the spirit. There is a sense in America of a capitalist system that has failed the majority of people, that needs to be questioned, debated, and the willingness to ask the question, can't we do better than capitalism, is what was the unifying theme across all these audiences. And I think it should give encouragement and heart to everyone listening to this program to understand how profoundly the wind has changed culturally and ideologically and philosophically in the United States. Capitalism is generating its own critics, its own opponents at a breathtaking rate.
Harriet, what was it like for you out there?
It was exciting. And even in Oakland, where the organization for which we spoke had not sent out publicity except to their own members, it was utterly full and with very young people. What they're aware of is that unemployment is crushing their future or their present, but they're unaware of the fact that it's crushing their personal lives as well.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you about, Harriet, and you too, Rick, because you have both contributed wonderful chapters to our new book, Imagine Living in a Socialist USA. Michael Ratner contributed a chapter on what he would do if he was the Attorney General. I wrote one on what law would be like in a different society. But you guys wrote about how you could organize the workplace differently. Rick did that one, and Harriet, you wrote about personal, emotional, and sexual life if we got rid of capitalism. That's what you talked about out in California, and that's what you wrote about in the book. And I wanted to ask you about that, Harriet. What is it about a capitalist society that is so crushing for us, and how do you envision, what do you imagine it would be like if we didn't have capitalism in terms of personal and emotional and sexual life?
Well, the first thing is about capitalism, that what matters is profit. As Marx said, accumulate, accumulate, accumulate. That is Moses and your prophets, you know. And so that in order to profit, companies have outsourced Americans' livings. And everything from manufacture to accounting, where you can just fax the materials over to India, where they speak English, get them back. or law, in terms of writing a brief and doing the research part of law, can be outsourced. And so people have been utterly looted in their personal lives because of only being a cipher on a profit ledger, not a person. And what has happened is 80% of the jobs that were lost in the recession were male jobs in manufacture, in the in construction, which is now prefab and often farmed out, and in other jobs that required physical strength, that's really not required anymore. And men are kind of getting outmoded. That role is outmoded. And particularly blue-collar men are no longer able to support their families. And there are two bases for male identity in the United States. One of them is a bread earner role, and the other is having a loyal sexual partner and wife. And they're both out the window, because what has happened is the deal was for women that men will be the primary earners and support you, particularly white males. This was not open for minorities whose women had to work. But the United States used to be more of a majority white country. Now it's for blue-collar males as well. And so that the same things that were being said about African-American males, that they're lazy and shiftless and disloyal and too sexual, are now being said about white males as their wives are leaving. And they're leaving because the old deal that you can be supported in exchange for domestic work and child care and emotional care and sexual care, that's out the window. And men feel so unmanned often by their losses on the job that they want women to compensate at home, and women are having none of it. So 70% of divorces are now initiated by women, and women are refusing to get married in the first place. And so that men are being rejected by women and by jobs. And a lot of manhood has to do with pride, which in the United States has been replaced by shame. And shame is something that the Republicans try to cultivate in anyone who doesn't have money. The shame of not being a real person because you can't go out and buy stuff. The shame of not being able to support a wife and children. And shame easily leads to violence. Men are increasingly more violent. That's why every week there's another shooting. And also, for a lot of young men who see before them this specter of an empty life, the choice is, instead of to endure the shame, and also the shame of bullying, which is a big factor, 4 times as many men as women commit suicide. And the one thing in common with all the mass shooters is that they're male. So what has happened is a disaster on the personal level, where men have been rejected and are furious and don't understand that it's capitalism that has disempowered them. And women don't have, and men don't have, government support so that there would be, as there is in France, free universal child care starting at 3 years old and subsidized care starting at 3 weeks after a well-paid maternity leave. Americans don't have the benefits of after-school care and child care and help for single mothers and quality free health care. And so these expenses devolve on people who can't pay them. So what is happening in personal life is the usual scenario of adulthood, marriage, children has collapsed. People are disempowered and confused. Women don't want to take care of men who won't be able to support them and still demand full domestic, emotional, and sexual services as well as childcare. And so that marriage and family has broken down for the first time in our entire history since they started looking at it in 1880 in the census. The majority of people at what they call prime marriageable age, 18 to 34, are unmarried. And the biggest increase in the kinds of married couples are married couples who don't have children. And the biggest increase in households is single-person households. People are alone. And if you're poor and alone, you can hang out at the mall if you're young and get arrested. Or you could sit in the library and try to get access to a computer on which to look for a job, which is trying to be accessed by a whole lot of other people while the library is being cut. And if you're rich, you have your own computer. You could go to a job and then come back and hang out with colleagues at a bar and buy drinks and food. If you're older, you can get escorted to events. If you're old and you're poor, you can stay in your poor little apartment in a dangerous place and feel scared to go to the park. So that there's been this outrageous personal divide. The marriages that last are overwhelmingly the marriages at the top. Sheryl Sandberg, whose book Leaning In was touted by Gloria Steinem as the new feminist manifesto, says, yes, you know, with these supports, you can do it all. She doesn't really mention that she has 9 full-time servants.
Helpful, right?
Very helpful with domestic work. She has several children. You know, she has sustained this marriage of hers. And so the statistics, just like the economic statistics, they're wildly skewed. At the top, marriages have a chance to last because you can outsource.
Look at all of us.
Yeah. You can outsource the laundry. You can outsource the children to the nanny and the expensive daycare. You can outsource the cooking to catering or takeout.
We're speaking with Rick Wolf and Harriet Fried, and we'll be right back after this break. Speaking with Harriet Fried and Rick Wolf, contributors to the new book, Imagine, Living in a Socialist USA, edited by me, Michael Smith, Debbie Smith, and Francis Golden. Well, Rick, you were out in California with Harriet, and you wrote an article for the book, Imagine, Living in a Socialist USA, called The Shape of a Post-Capitalist Future. That's what you talked about in California. You wrote about it in the book, and we want to ask you about that, too. Use your imagination. If we got rid of the bosses and we got rid of profit-making corporations, what kind of society do we want?
Well, I think in the past, when people have talked about socialism, and for perfectly understandable reasons, they focused on big issues, what we call in economics macro issues. Who would own the means of production? Would it be private individuals, as we have in capitalism, or would it be the society as a whole, with the government taking the dominant role and nationalizing means of production, that kind of idea? And sometimes also socialists thought to get rid of the market, the quid pro quo exchange of goods, and to substitute a rational economic planning apparatus. And whatever the virtues of those notions of socialism, I don't think in our present day and time they will win the hearts and minds of the people who have to support the idea. And I think socialism has to kind of come down from the lofty heights of ownership and planning and things like that, down to the nitty-gritty of everyday life. And so in the book, Imagine Socialism, I wanted to ask people to imagine with me what a socialist organization of the workplace, the store, the office, the factory, wherever it is you work, what it might be like different from the way it is in capitalism.
I'm glad you're going to that point, because I think one of the strengths of your chapter, I think, is that you take on exactly what you said. When you talk about socialism in the Soviet Union, Eastern Europe, and you basically are saying that some people would call it a kind of state capitalism, and whatever your conclusion is, that those models don't represent the only model of socialism. And I think that's what you're really saying to people. And I like that because, you know, in most people's minds, well, it's the Soviet Union, it's China, and we don't want that.
Yeah, and I think the way to get those people to rethink what socialism means is to revive parts of socialism that have gotten lost over the last century, but I think now need to be put in the foreground. And that's how it's going to change your daily life, whether it's in the household, and if we had time, we could talk about that. But what I concentrated on in the article was what would it mean if the place where people spend most of their adult life, at work, 5 out of 7 days, best hours of each of those 5 days, you're in your workplace. So let's talk about what socialism would mean differently from the way capitalism organizes it. In a capitalist workplace, the first thing that has to be faced, even though Americans try not to do it, is that it is a stunningly undemocratic arrangement. You go to work every day, most people do, in a factory office or a store, and a tiny handful of people, the board of directors, the major shareholders of the company, make all the decisions. What you do, how you do it, where you do it, when you do it. And when you're done, having produced a good or a service, they decide what happens to it. And whatever the profits are, they decide what happens to that too. In other words, you have no power, no participation in the decisions that affect your work life, even though that's the most important part of your adult life. That's stunning. If we're a democratic country, which we claim we are, if we're fighting wars in other parts of the world to bring democracy to them, which we claim we do as a nation, it is stunning that the place where adults spend most of their time and most of their lives is organized in a fundamentally undemocratic way. And so socialism has, in a sense, an easy offer to make people. How about we democratize the workplace? How about we bring democracy to the place it should have been instituted first in our society's history, if we're democratic, rather than last? And it wouldn't be so ironic that the people who propose to bring democracy to the workplace first are socialists, and who say the following: that the workplace ought to be organized democratically. All the workers in a workplace should together decide, in assemblies, democratically, what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, and what to do with the profits that, after all the workers help to produce. That would be a democratic workplace, and that's what socialism stands for at the level of everyday life in the work activity that we are all engaged in sooner or later for most of our adult lives. So let me spell out real briefly what benefits such a socialization of the workplace, which is simultaneously a democratization of the workplace. It really means the same thing, what it would achieve. So just a few. If the decision was, do we close the factory in Cincinnati, Ohio, and reopen it in Shanghai? If the workers together made the decision, you think they would vote to close the factory in Cincinnati where they live and move to Shanghai? I don't think so. In other words, here's a way to stop the exodus of jobs from the United States. Had we done it 30 or 40 years ago, we wouldn't have the Detroits and Clevelands and Camden, New Jerseys of the present. The wastelands of lost jobs, lost incomes, abandoned homes, and all the rest. Number two, if a toxic technology that raises your profits is being considered, if a board of directors 1,000 miles away makes a decision, They pick that technology. They want the extra profits. And if you don't like the bad air that that technology produces, well, you can move to some other job. But suppose the workers democratically in the workplace made the decision. Sure, on the one hand, they'd like to make more profits too. But on the other hand, they know they have to breathe the bad air. So do their spouses, so do their children, so do their neighbors. And guess what? Much more often, they decide to forgo the profits and keep their health. And we would have much less environmental destruction if the people who had to suffer the consequences made the decisions. But maybe here's the best one. We claim as a society to be concerned about growing inequality of income and wealth. The president's State of the Union message carried that idea as well, as previous statements of the president have over the last several months, almost as if he'd suddenly discovered that he lives in an unequal society. But if you really want to do something about income and wealth inequality, you have to understand this. The major source of inequality of wealth is how businesses distribute their net income, their profits. Who gets them? We know what is done with large corporations. We read about it every day in the press. They give their top officials $200 million bonus packages, $50 million bonus packages. We all hear it. And what they don't give to their top executives, they pay out in dividends to their shareholders. Little statistic for you to remember, 5% of the shareholders own 80% of the shares. So if you distribute dividends to shareholders, you're distributing to unequal distributions of wealth. If you don't want inequality of wealth and income and all the political corruption that goes with it, then the single best way to do it is to change the way the decision about how to distribute profits is made. Socialists want those decisions to be made democratically by all the workers. And guess what? If the workers together made the decision of how to distribute the profits they all help to produce, you think they would give millions of dollars to a few top executives and everybody else has to borrow money to send their kid to college? It would never happen. The inequality of wealth and income could be handled fundamentally better by socialists because they democratize a decision on how to distribute the profits that everybody helps to produce. Instead of wasting our time and dividing our nation with debates about this or that way to redistribute wealth, why not stop distributing it unequally in the first place? And the way to do that is to socialize, democratize the workplace. And so I want people to imagine how much better life would be if you handled the organization and the decision-making in the enterprises of this society, the institutions that make the goods and services we all depend on. If you bring socialism to them, you transform your work life and with it the entire society's distribution of wealth and income.
In the book that you and Harriet contributed to, Imagine Living in a Socialist USA, your two chapters are in the middle part of the book, which talks really about every institution in this society and how it would be dramatically transformed if we got rid of capitalism. The last part of the book is about how we get from where we are to where we want to be. And I know that when you were out in California and you had those huge crowds that you were addressing and people talking to you, and I know it's been my experience as well with promoting this book, people want to know, well, what do we do? We agree with you, but what do we do? So, Harriet, Rick, when they ask you that question, what's your response?
Well, the first thing you have to do is say, I can do it. Because Americans are at the point, I think, where they know that this is an unjust system, but they're not quite at the point where they can say, and I will do something about it. So even if it's calling six friends and saying, let's meet about this, let's figure it out, it's beginning to reach out to other people with the idea that we don't have to take this. So that is a huge thing to do. And there are viable organizations. The organization we spoke with in Oakland, which very sensible people working at all different jobs and taking on different actions to try to build an awareness of the need for socialism and how it could work. You need to be willing to join with other people is the primary thing. And I remember as a founding mother of the women's movement, getting this brochure about notes from the first year, 1968, about the first year of the women's movement. And I was in the committees to end the war in Vietnam as a young person. And I thought, okay, that's important. We're going to make this happen. It's a question of when people say, okay, I'll do it. And that's a very important thing that we're all trying to help people understand. We can do it, of course. Because, you know, Obama's speech was a perfect example of an utter bankruptcy where it comes to how to solve a problem. He didn't even mention the 11 million jobs that FDR gave people for the federal government, which started things going. And with the doubling of the population, at least it would be at least 22 million jobs. That would help get things rolling instead of more drones and more wars with countless expenses and no accountability, that people can put that together and then decide that they need to do something.
What do you think, Rick? What do you tell people when they ask you, what do we do next?
Well, I face the fact that we don't have, and that's a self-criticism of the left in the United States that is the least it owes itself. We don't have a viable organization of the left in the United States. We once had them. They were destroyed after World War II, partly by a systematic government attack, partly by a systematic business and conservative attack, and partly by their own catastrophic mistakes of strategic thinking. And we have to face that reality. So for me, when people ask me what to do, I say the first thing you have to understand is you have to get together with other people. This isolation that Harriet spoke about so movingly before is catastrophic politically. We are not going to get anything done as long as we all act individually. We have to face and recognize that there are millions of people who want to go beyond capitalism, who basically already agree that we can do better as a society than what we have in a capitalist system. And so the first order of business is to bring those people together, to make them aware that they're there and to make them aware that in unity and in solidarity, they can have an impact on this society far beyond what they can achieve individually. I work at that. I also work at the same time at trying to be honest that I don't know how best to get people to be together and function together. I am part of a generation here in the United States that didn't grow up with viable leftist organizations. Most of my life, the leftist organizations I encountered were in various stages of falling apart and have since fallen apart worse than they were when I was around them, and they weren't quite so decrepit. That has to be faced. You're not going to grow unless you understand that when you grow out of soil that is the dead result of what grew before. And so I think we have to be very open-minded. If the young people who had come together and produced Occupy Wall Street had met with me 3 or 4 months prior and had asked my advice about the wisdom of setting up tents in a public park, I would have said that seems a silly way to proceed, and I would have been wrong, and my advice would have been a disaster, and I'm very glad they didn't ask me my opinion, because they found a way in our culture to do something that taught millions of Americans that they're not alone, that their views are shared by millions of others. They got an enormous amount of sympathy from the larger population. They made mistakes, of course they did. But they were the beginnings of a recognition that we have to find new ways to come together. They learned they need more in the way of organization than they had. They need more in the way of focus than they had. Program. And those are important lessons. But you know, in order to learn those lessons, you have to have a spark. They provided the spark, and we're all in their debt for having done that against the advice of folks like us. So let's try all kinds of ways to get people together, as long as we understand we're all trying to bring together the critical mass that can make the difference. Imagine if you just took Roosevelt's Economic Bill of Rights from the end of his time as president, and you took it around the country, a little movement job, and got people to sign up. Yeah. And then you presented to the mass media the fact that a majority of Americans support this, the way we know that a majority of Americans have supported for years withdrawal from Iraq and Afghanistan, because they don't support that, the way recent reports show that Americans want a distribution of income and wealth radically more egalitarian than what, in fact, we have. So if we could begin to mobilize, it's important to understand that many of the ideas in this book, Imagine Socialism, are already majority points of view. So that, again, the lesson is we have less to do in the way of persuading and more to do in the way of mobilizing and organizing than we imagined, and that we have the numbers and we have the potential power. If we organize ourselves, that becomes real and transformative. And given the role of the United States in the larger world, imagine with me what message would be sent to the rest of the world if socialism becomes a powerful force inside the United States.
There are some organizations within the desert of American connectivity that thrived, and those are the 12-step programs, which are basically socialist. No one gets paid. Everyone works together. There is no hierarchy.
You mean the Alcoholics Anonymous,
Narcotics Anonymous, Gambling Anonymous, all the anonymous organizations. And the point of making them anonymous is there are no stars. We're in this together. And they have 12 steps. All of those steps, I wrote an article on that. You know, all of these steps could have a social dimension. Unfortunately, in AA, it's thought of as a personal cop-out to look at the social roots of your oppression. You know, why does the United States have more alcoholics than the other Western industrialized nations and more addicts? And to look at what they can teach us about people coming together without judgment, without there being one right way, telling their stories about what happened to them and sharing that. So it's possible to learn from those organizations, to go to those organizations, and one of those organizations has started and is expanding called ACA and Dysfunctional Families, taking cognizance of the fact that almost every family has dysfunction. And it's expanding particularly on the West Coast, where the social roots of your problem are not erased. And where the idea of maybe families ought to be supported and organized differently so that parents and children have different social supports are there. And they accepted as an addenda to their work an article that I wrote on, you know, 12 steps towards a revolution.
That would be good.
That's wonderful. Yeah.
I like that.
You know, one of the
12 years, right, Harriet?
I wanted to point out was Paul LeBlanc's article where he talks about the third American Revolution. The first was independence from England. The second was at least formal equality for black slaves. But he talks about the third American Revolution, which would be an economic revolution, where the wealth of this country would be restored to the people who create it. And he says in really a memorable phrase that American Socialist Revolution will come to nothing if it's not a movement by the majority for the majority. And I wanted to ask you your thoughts on that.
It's a profound insight, and one that I would restate as follows, because it might make it even a bit clearer. The second revolution he refers to, the one that abolished slavery, basically said in the United States, whatever else happens, it is now no longer possible for one human being to possess as property another one. And whatever else this results in, we will never go back. We will never allow one person to own another person. So I would add the following. Remember with me this simple logic. When you go to work for another person in a capitalist system, an employer, and you sit down and you work out with that employer what you will do, you also work out what that employer will pay you. Let's say, just for the sake of argument, $20 an hour. You know, even if you never study economics, that the following is true. That the only reason that employer will ever give you $20 an hour is if during that hour your brains and your muscles produce more than $20 worth of stuff for that employer to sell. Because at the end of the day, you go home and whatever you produced belongs to the employer. So the employer will only give you 20 if he gets from you more than 20. That means that in a capitalist system, the condition for your working is always to produce more for the employer than he gives you. That is a fundamentally unequal relationship. All that socialism does is say that you as a worker, if you produce more than you're paid, that you are part of the collective that gets the more you produced. You become your own employer. And what socialism says is we ought to put that in our constitution. Nobody produces surpluses extra for anybody else. We produce the surplus beyond what we get paid for ourselves collectively. That's what socialism means economically. It's the fundamental end to what used to be called exploitation. We don't have some people who live off the extra produced by others. We produce it for ourselves.
Thank you, Rick Wolf. Thank you, Harriet Fraud. Thank you for your wonderful contributions to the new book, Imagine Living in a Socialist USA. We certainly appreciate your coming down today to be on Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Same here.
Thank you very much. It was really interesting. And the book is great. Your essays are two of the highlights. And it's,
thank you.
What's good about it is it's written in a way that even I can understand it, which is a good start.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
I want to use that so much, yeah.